Welcome to the U.S. National Privacy Legislation Podcast. This is Joy Mason-Intriago, Managing Director of the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. We are the only professional association that combines all aspects of data and cyber governance for the governance, risk, and compliance professional. You can find us online at adcg.org. It gives us great pleasure to host this event led by two outstanding moderators, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. Jerry is a founder of Buckley LLP, a national financial services law firm based in Washington, D.C. Prior to entering private practice, he served as minority staff director of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Jody is CEO of Global Cyber Risk LLC and chairs the American Bar Association's Privacy and Computer Crime Committee. We have some really great guests lined up today and in the future, so please be sure to rate us and subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode.
This is Jody Westby, and I'm here today with my co-host, Jerry Buckley, and our guest, Jill Reber, General Manager of Data Privacy for Logic 2020. Jill has an interesting background for today's podcast, having begun her career as a lawyer, then moving into the tech entrepreneurial space with Primitive Logic, which she sold to Logic 2020 last year. Jill, you've been working with companies for a couple of decades now as they've tried to manage enterprise architecture, large-scale systems integration, and end-to-end data initiatives, all in this rapidly evolving environment that is viewing data as the new currency. With California's passage of the CCPA, privacy is, I'll say, lit up again in the U.S. Do you think the time is right for a national privacy law?
Actually, a few years ago would have been the right time for a national privacy law, but first of all, let me thank you for having me. This is a really timely discussion, and I appreciate being a part of it. But in all seriousness, I think the U.S. is a little late to the party. We're scratching the surface of privacy regulations as compared to other countries, but now is definitely better late than never. And absent a federal data privacy law, CCPA, as the most comprehensive state law, has become kind of a de facto national law. And then, as you know, CCPA was just amended via a November ballot with CPRA, also known as CCPA to us Californians, to more closely align with the GDPR concepts. And then other states are following suit. For example, Washington State, which has tried and failed a couple of times, has resurfaced their Data Privacy Act. And I believe they're scheduled for a public hearing later today. And there's a lot of overlap with CCPA as amended by CPRA. And then Washington goes a little further by responding to the COVID pandemic by including provisions around the processing of personal data for public health emergencies, including contract tracing. I've talked with some businesses who have made the mistake of thinking, well, I'm in North Carolina or Texas, so I don't really have to worry about California privacy laws. But as we know, digital data really has no geographical boundaries. So any B2C company that has a website that can be accessed by California residents really needs to be aware of their obligations and individuals' data privacy rights under CCPA. And we'll need to be aware of how other states are going to affect their obligations. And then as other states propose and discuss and enact their own data privacy laws, businesses, they want to avoid that whack-a-mole game by trying to adapt to various regulations with similar principles, but slightly different applications. And businesses really need to be able to build technology systems and business processes that can operationalize their obligations and the individual privacy rights that are common to the privacy regulations that apply to them. I think a federal standard would go a long way to providing more certainty for business in that respect. And then, if I may, there's still, you know, there's even more complexity when we consider the cross-border transfer complexities for multinational businesses that happened with the Schrems II case, the states are really unable to fully address the U.S. surveillance issues like FISA and NSA surveillance that form the basis for the Court of Justice invalidating Privacy Shield as a cross-border transfer mechanism. So a federal privacy law also would be able to address the crux of that situation. So hopefully Congress will be able to pull together a national privacy law this year.
Well, I hope so. I do think you've done a great job summarizing all those various factors that are all coming together, and perhaps we'll put more pressure on the federal level for everyone to get together and get a national privacy law. I want to turn this over to my co-host, Jerry Buckley. Jerry?
Well, thank you, Jody. And Jill, thank you for being with us. We really appreciate your perspective. And in fact, I think you did an excellent summary, Jody said, of the environment we're in. But your background is so broad, and you've worked with companies wrestling with the GDPR compliance and other global privacy requirements. I think you've hinted at this already, but what are your thoughts on how national privacy law might fit into the bigger global privacy landscape, which is largely revolving at the present around the EU? Can you share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I'm a big fan of establishing a global privacy framework. The impact of any data regulation, unless you're strictly a national company, is really global. Because as I mentioned, digital data has no geographical boundaries. I kind of analogize it to environmental actions and regulations. And countries understand that their environmental actions have global effect, and we have the Paris Accord to try to put together some global standards. And with emission standards just in the US, California has the toughest standards, and auto manufacturers aren't going to make different cars for different states. So I kind of view that similar to need for a global privacy program, because multinational businesses really need to have some clarity around what's expected of them. We've been advising our clients to take the highest standards applicable to them from each of the regulations, but the privacy landscape is always evolving with new laws and new guidelines and new legal interpretations. So, you know, the key driver, if we keep our focus on the growing consumer and business expectations that business people's data must be handled with respect, and the common theme underlying each of these laws, which is to give consumers more control over their personal data by improving privacy and transparency, control over data proliferation and security. And then from what I can see, GDPR is being held up as the gold standard for others to follow. Some countries are going a little further, like Brazil's requiring DPO for all businesses, Canada's CPPA, not to be confused with CPRA or the other ones. Their updates to PIPEDA include an appropriateness test, which puts it a little bit beyond other countries. And I like their 5-point reasonable person test. And they say you can only collect and use what a reasonable person would expect to be collected under the circumstances. And they prohibit collection or use of personal data to manipulate individuals. So there are already jurisdictions that are going slightly further than GDPR in some respects. And GDPR, we have to keep in mind, was passed in 2016, 4 years ago, and technology continues to evolve. And then also the cross-border transfers, as I mentioned, they're getting more complicated with things like Schrems II and validating Privacy Shield. And that affects trillions of dollars of trade between the EU and the US. And then Brexit complicates things even more with that. So technology has really thrust us into a global economy and broken down geographical barriers. And, you know, our clients, the multinational businesses, need to have some clarity around what's expected of them with respect to data. So yeah, I think a U.S. federal privacy law is just the first step, and we really need some consistency with the global privacy landscape. So I think a positive next step would be to work with the EU, Canada, Brazil, New Zealand, and other countries that are active in the data privacy space for a unified global privacy landscape.
And as you observe, Jill, the absence of a national standard in the United States or national legislation And in fact, the absence of a designated U.S. representative to the world. Yes, we have FTC, we have Commerce, we have State, we have others who are involved. But our lack of national unity on this issue, Jody and I both believe, is a significant disadvantage for the United States. I don't think there's any disagreement about that. What is kind of stunning to me is that there has not come together, even though Business Roundtable, others have spoken in the Commerce Committee, in the Senate about, and in other committees, about the need for national legislation. It doesn't seem to have caught yet. I think this may be the year, but it doesn't seem to have caught that this is, that data is the lifeblood of our economy, even more so now post-COVID, and that the importance of this has to be appreciated both with the new administration and with the Congress coming back. Would you agree with that?
I couldn't agree more with you, Jerry. I think that our federal government has been stymied a little bit in its ability to come together on common principles. And I think that our configuration right now may be a little bit more amenable to kind of moving the needle forward there. But I'm an eternal optimist, so I can only hope.
Jill, I'd like to expand the conversation in another direction and ask you about data governance, which certainly has to be considered in any privacy conversation. Your focus now, your primary focus with your clients, is helping them operationalize their data privacy regulations and data governance. And as I ask you about data governance, please tell us what that means to you, because I would like to ask about how have these general principles of data governance expanded in the context of the data privacy regulations. So what does data governance mean, and how have the principles of data governance really been expanded due to the privacy laws that we're talking about?
Okay, so first, I believe most significantly, there's a new need to kind of break down the business silos. That's been the basis of enterprise architectures for the last few decades, and create data governance working groups. And here in the U.S., the CPRA amendments to CCPA increase the need for focused and regularly updated data and system mapping. And I think that, you know, getting a complete understanding of the company's data flows, both inside and out, full data lifecycle, that's the start of data governance and data management. Mm-hmm. And so we have to regularly update. So we've expanded that by having to regularly update, and then the outputs of those, the data and systems inventories, the data flow diagrams, the data retention practices, they're all used for the inputs for the legal folks to make sure that the privacy policies and the contracts actually represent the data flows and meet the requirements of the regulations. Okay, so far so good. Then consider these three concepts from CPRA that I think increase the data governance burden. So yeah, we've added purpose limitation. Tell me why you're collecting my information and don't use it for a different purpose. So the duty to approve secondary uses. Don't collect more information than you need to do the thing you're going to do with my storage limitation. Tell me how long you're going to keep my information, and then don't keep it longer. And all of this with CPRA amendments needs to be disclosed at the point of collection. So businesses now have to have internal processes and systems that will flag any use as not anticipated at the time of collection. And for siloed enterprises with siloed data sets that are shared among lines of business or departments, this can really be a governance challenge. And lines of business that are access points for personal data are really going to need to have a heightened understanding of not only where that data travels throughout the organization and whether it's shared outside the organization, but also how it's being used and why. And then when data sets are being used by multiple lines of businesses or departments, they're going to need to tightly coordinate, for example, when an initially stated use is no longer relevant for one department, but may still be relevant to another department, there needs to be a control in place so that the first line of business doesn't destroy data that's still being legitimately used by another line of business. then you have to have the, you know, typical governance mechanism in place for appropriate reviews and internal checks and balances. Because with the privacy landscape, there's so many triggers, both internal and external to the business, that can alter the data privacy ecosystem. You can have technology innovations externally that get used internally, or changing business priorities, for example, that can enable uses of data that are different from the uses that are specified in the organization's consent documents or the privacy notices. Or you can have new service providers and data processors, and then that requires alterations to the organization's data map and a review of the outside company's privacy and security protocols, and then a review of contracts. And then also, as COVID-19 now requires many employees to work from home, we're seeing a lot of new uses of technology that can affect the ongoing accuracy of system inventories and data flows. And then externally, as we've mentioned, the regulatory landscape is always evolving. So being in a state of readiness one day may not mean that it holds true the next. We're also in an active M&A environment. So there are M&A triggers. Does the target have a robust data privacy program? So that the target brings in new personal data, new vendors and partners, new processes and applications. So instead of being the, quote, new currency, personal data can quickly become a liability if privacy due diligence is not handled thoroughly. So I think businesses need to establish alliances between the data privacy offices, the legal, the business, the data management folks, HR, marketing, and security, to do all of this together as a group. And really, I'm a big fan of kind of breaking down the silo mentality.
Well, you're right. And this is where the rubber meets the road, because this is where companies really start to understand how this is impacting their systems and their processes and their policies. And this is where it starts to really cost the money. It's more than just, oh, we developed a privacy policy and hired a chief privacy officer. Now we're talking changes to applications and systems and really understanding how the data is flowing through those IT systems, which in my experience, my clients do not have a good handle on what data they have and where it is, much less trying to meet all the privacy compliance and other considerations that you brought out so clearly.
Your clients are not alone, trust me.
That really does, you know, bring us to, you know, your discussion of this legal landscape and the complexities that are involved, leave one, you know, scratching your head and saying, how are companies going to comply with these requirements and understand what their obligations are? It's one thing for a multinational company with large resources to do this, but they are not the only companies impacted by it. There are smaller and mid-sized companies for whom this will be a fairly significant challenge. In your experience, what are the biggest problems clients are having managing their privacy requirements, Jill?
All right. So how long do we have today?
All right.
All right. I'll just touch on a few of the ones that I'm seeing most frequently. First of all, the rights to control and determine what happens with data that are given to individuals with the data privacy regulations, combined with enterprise architectures that were not developed with that concept in mind, kind of creates a, you know, we're starting on the back foot. Because complex enterprise legacy systems can be tricky. Most legacy information architectures were created with the siloed minds of business and siloed data sets, as we discussed. So having to follow the data trail in an environment that was architected in a siloed fashion without the data subject minds in right is really a challenge. And it requires businesses to firmly get their arms around the full data lifecycle and how it proliferates both inside and outside their business, with the understanding of why they have the data and how they use it, and to fully understand how it permeates through the siloed organization. So, for example, you can grab data from the data warehouse, and that's great, but how much are they missing? Because a data subject's information can wind up in a dozen or more separate systems. And while data proliferation may be necessary for the business operations, many organizations don't adequately track that movement, replication, and access to the data across the internal lines of business. So again, these lines of businesses often have varying levels of maturity on the day-to-day processes and data uses, and the lack of documentation and the unification across those lines of businesses puts the organization at risk of non-compliance. A second related challenge is what I call a data privacy vision gap. So sometimes a data privacy officer has a really clear vision of the data privacy readiness, the what behind all of these regulations, but then pushes it down to the lines of business who are on their own to figure out the how. So that creates a lack of uniformity in how the DPO's vision of the data privacy programs operationalized across the organization. And that can present a couple of major challenges. You know, your lack of consistency with each line of business approaching data privacy is going to create non-compliance. There's just no two ways about that. So then that leads into the difficulties maintaining readiness and governance that we talked about. And then there's a third one that's a pretty big one, I think. The three CPRA concepts that I just mentioned, talking about the governance challenges, but they can also present process and system challenges. So with purpose limitation and transparency, you need to know not just what is there, but why. And in the U.S., this just became more important with CPRA passing, because CPRA introduces a new focus on data uses with increased transparency requirements that bring us closer to the GDPR standards. So that can create problems as the data flows among the different lines of businesses with different objectives. And then you've got the minimization and storage limitation principles. So collect as little as needed, understand why you're collecting it, give access to as few as necessary, keep it for the shortest time as possible. So storage limitation, marketing and legal are going to have very different perspectives on the retention needs. So how do you resolve that operationally? And then how do you make sure data is actually destroyed when it has permeated through so many different systems? And then with data minimization, again, the engineers and the marketing personnel are going to have different views on this than the internal operations and the people folks. So, you know, getting some uniformity across the organization for how data is being used is just, that's a challenge. And then finally, believe it or not, verifying that your data subject is really the person making the DSAR, that has presented some challenges, you know, because if you get that wrong, you are creating possible identity theft, you know, and security breaches. So you're creating compliance issues for yourself. And so multi-factor authentication can help, but that can still be problematic if an individual, for example, behind the subject access request or the delete request doesn't have an account with the business. So there are just some operational things that I think really need to be considered in any legislative activities that are going on.
As you were talking, I was thinking how prescient Joy is in having launched the ADCG effort, because the educational aspects of this, the need to understand these areas, is so great. And it is, as you say, evolving. It's happening real time. And the ability to have a place where you can go to learn about this is extremely important. And, you know, how are, and to compare notes with other companies, how are companies helping each other to meet compliance requirements?
So there are various industry groups, some informally and some a little more formally. You know, industries with similar concerns, they're having some group meetings. Like certainly the digital advertising groups, a little more formal, very active in this space, especially with respect to third-party cookies and how that applies in terms of whether it's a sale or sharing. As another example, I participate in a biweekly, very informal financial services industry group meeting, and we talk about things that are of interest to the financial industry in particular with respect to the data privacy regulations. For example, most of the regulations have a GLBA carve out, but there's an issue, and the GLBA applies to customers. So the definition of what's covered by GLBA compliance is a lot more narrow than what it is with the data privacy regulations. So the discussions on that point, for example, are around whether you just ignore the GLDA exception or whether you continue to use it or see it. But then that gets into other architecture issues too, because if you're going to use that but still comply with the data privacy regulations, how do you architect for two different business processes and business flows? But those are just some examples. I think that there's a HIPAA carve-out also, so I'm sure there are medical similar groups, and then I know that there are also some retail groups that just meet informally, like how do we just navigate this evolving territory?
Jill, I have been, in fact, I have a meeting this afternoon with another of the financial institutions data protection groups that has a lot of the banking and non-banking financial services types. We should compare notes between those groups if we get a chance. But one of the things that is pretty clear is to me is that the GLDA exception, which as you note, is only has a limited value anyway, because of the nature of what it covers and the fact that the state enactments go beyond that. I also think, and I think you probably would agree, that over the long run, that's not going to be a shelter and that the financial services industry is going to have to be a part of the general privacy environment. Although it will be fascinating because the new chair of the banking committee will be Sherrod Brown of Ohio, and he has his own views that are different than those of the Commerce Committee. So it'll be interesting to see how that all gets sorted out. But look forward to further conversation with you on that subject.
In listening to you two, I was reminded of Apple's initiative for application transparency. You were discussing what various companies are doing. And Apple also issues a transparency report on government requests for consumer data, which sort of butts heads with the surveillance issues that the EU has raised. So do you see this type of corporate action becoming a trend, like what Apple's transparency efforts? Is that something that you see other companies may start replicating?
Yeah, absolutely. So with the application transparency, we're talking about Apple's impending change to the iPhone's operating system. It's designed to alert users when an app is going to track your personal data, like location or browsing history. And companies like Facebook use that data to target their ads. So obviously Facebook's kind of not happy with that. But the alert gives you the option, the user, the option to block the tracking before using the app. And it's designed to let you know how the app plans to track you, but it's not banning tracking altogether. So yeah, I think that's going to become a trend. People are really paying attention to how their personal data is being used with a new lens. And then other companies are already making movement with respect to individual data privacy, like Chrome and Safari browsers are moving in the direction of reducing data collection and giving users more control over their privacy choices. Microsoft is kind of a leader in this space also. They challenge secrecy orders when the government requests its customers emails or documents. In one case, there was an amicus brief in support of Microsoft's position that was filed by its competitors, Amazon, Apple, and Google. So already companies are starting to slide there. But I think the driving force is going to be consumers' expectations. I believe the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal was kind of a wake-up call for consumers about how companies are using their personal data. People weren't right on the bandwagon, but now, 2 years later, 90% of Americans view privacy as a fundamental right. 80% of consumers are willing to spend time and money to protect their personal data. 75% of people won't buy a product from a company if they don't trust it to protect their personal data. And then with smart devices and personalization, which are a big part of any digital transformation efforts, there's a huge tension between privacy on the one hand and personalization and connectivity on the other. So I really believe that Apple is reading the tea leaves correctly when it comes to consumers. And then in light of the Facebook Cambridge Analytica affair and other high-profile scandals, many consumers are really demanding to know now how companies are using their personal data, and they're reevaluating their relationships with businesses who use it irresponsibly. And then the CPRA amendments to CCPA included the concepts of don't monitor me. So it gives people the right to say, don't use my sensitive personal information, don't track me from device to device, and don't track me across unrelated businesses, and don't manipulate me. So CPRA adds a concept of cross-context behavioral advertising, and this prohibits targeted advertising based on a profile or predictions about the consumer related to the consumer's activities over time and across multiple businesses or distinct branded services and websites or applications. And then the CPRA also adds a new concept. I hadn't seen this in any other laws specifically, the dark patterns, which is, you know, any user interface that kind of reinforces filter bubbles or lessens consumers' choices or their autonomy. Right. And, you know, so those are new concepts that, so I think the consumer push and the regulatory movement is really moving toward trust and ethical use of data. So I really would expect many companies to follow Apple's lead.
You are exactly right that Cambridge Analytica was the point in time when people began to understand big data. Then began to understand, oh, this is what they meant. And it was a turning point for consumers. And I think it will be also a driver of anything we adopt in the US as national legislation. The trust in the marketplace, too, is something I've talked about for a long time, that if you have trust with your consumers, with your business partners, you have a competitive edge. But that concept, too, was understood by so few. And so there really are, you've done a great job in bringing out so many issues that are really pushing and are forces that are, I kind of see them as outside forces all pushing toward the middle, that it was going to have to be considered. Do you think that these types of privacy of initiatives, though, are really going to have much of an influence on the lawmakers when they're actually drafting legislation?
Absolutely. I kind of look at it as a chicken or egg, because I think the consumers are pushing that, and legislation, privacy legislation, has already influenced these types of initiatives, because all regulations are designed to give individuals more control over their personal data and aimed at improving not just the privacy, but the transparency and control over data proliferation and security. So that requirement, I think, was why I think Apple's move was really brilliant, because they're addressing that transparency. And the regulations have created a shift, I think, in the balance of power of data from businesses to the individuals. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer is yes, and because I think it's each one is influencing the other. And I think that we can see maybe a little bit of a snowball effect with the consumer expectations and the business trends, like what Apple's doing. And, you know, CCPA already requires that businesses give consumers the option to do not sell my personal data. So I think Congress has a role to play in bringing laws that were enacted when companies stored records in cabinets or computer files or on their hard drives into the current age of cloud computing, then also in aligning us with the rest of the world and consumers' expectations.
Well, it's going to be interesting, but the consumers certainly have more power behind them now and a better chance at getting more protections than they have ever had. And it's going to, I think, cause a number of companies to also realize they need to work with the consumers more, because if they don't, they could be losing market share. It's very interesting to see how the patient little consumer has stood by the side and just kept saying, I want privacy. And now they're maybe finally going to get something reasonable, we hope. Before I hand this back to Jerry, because I know we're getting to the end, I want to thank you. This has really been a wonderful interview, and you brought out so many good points here for consideration. And thank you, Jill, so much for your time today. Jerry, let me hand this back to you.
I thank you, and I join in that sentiment. I had a last question. I'll ask it, and I know our time is running out, so maybe we'll just see if we can cover this very briefly. But, you know, you mentioned the term data protection readiness, and there's the separate term privacy readiness. How do you compare those two terms?
So I'm going to break the answer down into two parts, and I will do this quickly. I actually talk with our clients about readiness versus compliance, because I think everybody's worried about compliance with the regulations, but compliance is really just a snapshot at a point of time. And especially in a remote work environment, most businesses are running in right now, operational and system changes with remote forces make those companies de facto technology companies, which is kind of forcing a digital transformation in just a few weeks. And so you can be in a state of compliance 1 minute, and then an employee shares a home computer or even just leaves handwritten notes out. And then even in the non-remote workforce situation, an employee puts something on a thumb drive, so you're out of compliance. And then there's any of the triggers that we talked about earlier in the governance conversation. So all of that can throw a company out of compliance. And so that's why I prefer to talk about data privacy readiness with adherence to appropriate periodic reviews. With respect to the data protection readiness versus the data privacy readiness, they're often used somewhat interchangeably. I mean, think about it. GDPR is the Global Data Protection Regulation. CCPA, as amended, is still the California Consumer Privacy Act. And they both have similar goals and obligations and individual rights. But in my mind, data protection equals data privacy plus data security, kind of like a Venn diagram. And the overlap, you know, all I'm going to go out on a limb, all data privacy laws that I know of have data security components in them, because most require implementing appropriate technical and organizational measures to ensure the level of security that's appropriate to the risk. So it's hard to have data privacy without security, but you can have cybersecurity without data privacy. So that's what I see as the little nuance. But
I think the nuance is it's a very good point. I personally, even though privacy is the word we use in the United States, and in fact, these podcasts have been titled Prospects for National Privacy Legislation, I really do think that data protection probably captures it better. And I think you're indicating the same, because it's a holistic, both the cyber risk and the data use limitations are equally important. I hope that Jody would agree with that. So again, thank you so much, Jill, for your presentation. As we said earlier, you covered a wide range and gave deeper insights in a number of areas than we've had in prior episodes. So we thank you so much for your participation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I actually love talking about this stuff. Sometimes my colleagues have to throw a net over me, but I really appreciate it.
Well, we won't throw a net over you. We're glad you joined us.
Thanks for joining us this week on U.S. National Privacy Legislation. Make sure to visit our website, adcg.org, where you can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in what you heard today, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the podcast, that would help us out too. Also, you might want to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Data and Cyber Governance Alert, which you can do right on our homepage. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode, where we dig deeper into the possibilities of U.S. national privacy legislation.